When it comes to the state's redistricting process, Dixie Hoefner, a member of the Utah Citizens Council, has some concerns.
The fox is guarding the hen house. To use a military analogy, gerrymandering is like allowing one side's military not only to control where to position its own troops, but where to position the troops of the opposing army to be sure that the opposing troops are outmaneuvered in all major battles. Allowing politicians to decide who votes where means they can defeat the other side before the elections even start.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, the Utah Citizens Council highlights policy issues of concern, including environmental health, public education financing, Medicaid expansion, gun control, affordable housing, and redistricting. All that's coming up on the program today. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. This week, the Utah Citizens Council, a nonpartisan group of retirees with a broad collective experience with policy issues spanning many disciplines and expertise, gathered to address their top policy priority areas that they want Utahns to pay attention to and Utah lawmakers to urgently address. For the past several years, the Utah Citizens Council has released an independently researched annual report that assesses progress towards policy objectives to advance human rights in Utah. This week, they highlighted some key policy areas for their 2017 report. The panel of presenters included John Bennion, who served as superintendent of the Salt Lake City and Provo school districts in Utah, Michael Diley, a former state director with the Utah Medicaid program, Dixie Hoefner, a former professor of special education and law at the University of Utah, Cheryl May, a former adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science, Dee Rowland, a former government liaison for the Catholic Diocese of Utah, and Andy Schoenberg, a former professor of biophysics and bioengineering at the University of Utah. The event was co-sponsored by the Lowell Bennion Community Service Center, and the forum was introduced by Dean McGovern, the Bennion Center's executive director.
The Utah Citizens Council is a nonpartisan group of Republicans, Democrats, and the growing group of unaffiliated politically unaffiliated. All of them are retirees and with considerable collective experience in public policy. They're armed with wisdom and experience and civic responsibility. This group works very hard throughout the year to make a positive impact on all of our lives. If you go no further than the name of the group, you can understand the deliberate and thoughtful purpose of this team. The word citizens is actually pluralized. It's a plural possessive, which underscores the idea that the outcomes of the group are intended for all of us to be shared, and the outcomes belong to all of us. The word council, you'll note, is not the C-I-L council, it's the S-E-L council. And this shift or switch stresses the importance of the democratic process and the public engagement through dialogue rather than closed-door, back-room decision-making. This council is open to all of us, and we are thankful. It's wonderful to have the younger generation and the older generation today sharing interest in important public policy matters, and we'll talk about some of those today. Today's forum marks the release of the Utah Citizens Council, their fourth annual report, which assesses the progress or lack of progress of public policy relevant to all of us in Utah. Today, the members of the Utah Citizens Council are going to briefly summarize key recommendations, as Nick mentioned: environmental health, public education, health and health care, personal security, social support systems, and participatory governance. I will let each member of the council introduce themselves, and we will have a question and answer session that follows. Hard copies of their annual report will be available after our presentation today, and they're available up here at the desk. And they will also be available, if you don't like it in hard paper copy, if you can find it on the website at www.utahcitizenscouncil.org. Make sure you spell it correctly, and it's all one word. To the panel.
Thank you for the opportunity to present our report for this year. We have Article 1 up here on the slide, but this year we chose not to address that issue. In last year's report, we talked a lot about immigration. We figure this year there wasn't much we could really contribute. It's mostly in the federal hands right now. So this report actually skips Article 1. So we go directly to the Article 2. Let me say something about myself. I'm a retired professor at the University of Utah. I was in bioengineering and rehab medicine. In my retirement, I have developed a solar-powered electric vehicle that I drive around town. You may have seen it in Mill Creek Canyon. I think that's maybe one of the reasons I'm on the committee with Dave Carrier, who is helps a lot with the logistics here. The environmental health article is, all Utahns, young and old, have the right to live and thrive in a healthy environment that includes clean air, land, water, and share in the responsibility to pass that healthy environment on to succeeding generations. Our main focus this year, again, is on air quality and water issues. What's new in this report is we've addressed the difficult subject here in Utah of global warming, and also we added the issue of population growth. As you may have heard, we're expecting to double the population in Utah by 2065, 1 million more people in Utah County alone. The impact on air and water quality obviously is an issue. That picture, by the way, is taken of the corner of Mount Olympus in Olympus Cove. I'm going to mostly address the air quality issue in this presentation, and as a background of information, we have here on the positive side, the legislature this year did extend the tax credit for renewable energy systems for homes and businesses. The tier three fuels, which have lower sulfur content, which helps reduce the amount of pollution created by cars, is well on its way, and probably we'll see a lot of it by 2019. And the electric vehicle sales are growing exponentially here in Utah and have reached almost 1% this year. We're installing a lot of charging stations, both at businesses and on highways and publicly. And then, of course, Salt Lake City and some of the other towns here in Utah have pledged to look at reducing emissions by improving buildings and installing solar and wind. On the not so good side, the EPA has said that Utah is not meeting its air quality standards, and so the Utah DEQ is in the process of creating a new SIP plan, its state implementation plan to clean up the environment. One of the disconcerting things is if you analyze the situation as far as purchases of vehicles. And as shown on this slide, last year, Utahns bought 67% of the vehicles bought were SUVs and trucks. And those things don't get 30 miles to the gallon, and some of them get below 20. And this situation is not improving. The first half of this year, that proportion of people buying the gas guzzlers is increased to 70%. That does not speak well for us being able to clean up the environment. The legislature also did not encourage the purchase of electric vehicles this year. They've eliminated the tax incentive for it. So our recommendations basically on those problem areas are, reintroduce legislation that did not pass this year. In 2018, we've put a pollution tax on gas guzzling or highly polluting vehicles. Renew tax credits for low emissions vehicles. And one of the new ones is, I think we need to start in our advertising on television and otherwise, make the public aware the gas consumption as well as the pollution index of vehicles. Maybe that will make us shift a little bit more towards buying more efficient vehicles. I mentioned it that we did include the water issue. There was a big report issued this year by the State Commission on what to do about water availability. Our committee again urges that we look more at conservation and less use of water, particularly in watering lawns and so on, and try to emphasize that before we spend a billion or $2 billion on a project like building the Lake Powell pipeline. In a nutshell, that's kind of a summary of the environmental part. I did put down that we are going to have a major symposium on November 3rd to talk about the global warming issue. Thank you for your attention.
And that was Andy Schoenberg, a former professor of biophysics and bioengineering at the University of Utah, speaking as a member of the Utah Citizens Council.
My name is John Bennion. I'm the former superintendent of schools in the Salt Lake City School District and the Provo School District, and former clinical professor of educational administration and urban education in the College of Education here at the U. I'm representing the Education Committee. You'll see the article up there that reads, which we address, "All Utahns have the right to a public education that ensures literacy, numeracy, critical thinking, character development, and the capability for responsible citizenship to help secure a promising future for Utah in a complex, interdependent, and competitive world." The Education Committee this year has been focusing our attention on the Our Schools Now voter initiative, launched by community leaders, including high-profile business leaders in Utah that recognize that the future of our economy and of the quality of life in the state depend on a well-educated citizenry. Business leaders recognize that public education in Utah has been underfunded for many years, resulting in a growing teacher shortage and troubling student achievement deficits, particularly when compared with peer states with similar demographics. Not only does Utah remain dead last in per pupil expenditure, but has been dropping in the percent of tax revenue going to public education for a number of years now. Back in the 1990s, we were able to say that though our pupil per expenditure was low, we ranked among the highest in the nation in the percent of the state budget that supports schools. That is no longer the case. According to a recent report, by 2010, Utah had slipped to 29th in effort or priority given to the support of public education relative to other state expenditures. The fact that business leaders were so involved in launching and supporting this initiative is very significant in my experience here in Utah. The initiative calls for a 0.45% increase in the income tax and a 0.4% increase in the sales tax, except on food. Those two modest increases, if approved by the voters, will raise an additional approximately $700,000.
$700 million,
sorry. Much more impressive. To support public education, which is even less than was spent many, many years ago until the legislature went to a flat income tax and made other tax reductions. 85% of the additional revenue would go to the K-12 schools and 15% to higher education. The funds would go directly to the school districts that would develop general guidelines with a view toward increasing student learning. Each school then would develop its own plan for increasing student achievement and receive its share of the funding based on the number of pupils in each school. Schools would have considerable latitude as to how best to use those funds to get higher levels of student achievement. In other words, the distribution of the additional funds would be highly decentralized as long as schools show evidence each year of student achievement progress. To get the initiative on the ballot, thousands of signatures of registered voters need to be gathered across the state, and that signature gathering process is well underway, over a quarter of the way there now. We are urging voters to sign the petition so that Utah citizens will have the opportunity to vote on the initiative next fall. I have one more signature to get on the one I'm circulating now. And in over 70, I have had nobody turn me down. And it simply is asking that it go on the ballot, and then people can make their choice. It's my understanding after this meeting, there'll be somebody out here at the table with this petition. If you haven't had a chance to sign it, would like to, you'd have that opportunity. We urge also that the legislature scale up publicly funded, high-quality preschools in low-income areas in the state. With the few pilot programs that have been going on, funded by the state, it has been demonstrated that high-quality preschools narrow the opportunity gap much more efficiently and more effectively than during later school years. Prevention of learning gaps is far better than later attempts at remediation. We urge in the report that the legislature, if the voters approve the initiative, not reduce the level of state support currently given, but rather continue to fund growth, keep up with inflation, and increase funding for publicly supported high-quality preschools and full-day kindergartens in schools that serve low-income families.
That was John Bennion, who served as superintendent for both Salt Lake City and Provo school districts. He spoke as part of a presentation by the Utah Citizens Council at the University of Utah this week to highlight the group's 2017 report. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them as a public service to you. Today, we are broadcasting a forum recorded this week with members of the Utah Citizens Council. They are a human rights advocacy organization, and they wanted to highlight their recently released report for 2017 titled Standing Up for Utah's Needs. You can find a link to this report on our website. The speakers include Andy Schoenberg, a former professor of biophysics and bioengineering at the University of Utah, John Bennion, who served as superintendent of the Salt Lake City and Provo school districts, Dixie Huffner, a former professor of special education and law at the University of Utah, Cheryl May, a former adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science, and Dee Rowland, a former government liaison for the Catholic Diocese of Utah. And speaking next is Michael Diley, a former state director of the Utah Medicaid program.
Good afternoon. My name is Michael Diley. I guess in full disclosure, I'm one of those retirees that still works. I work as a health policy consultant. But prior to that, I spent 37 years with the state of Utah on Health and Human Services and as state Medicaid director from 1995 to 2005. So I will be talking about the health. And it's Article 4, which states, all Utahans have the right to comprehensive quality health care at a reasonable cost and reasonable societal efforts to help them achieve and maintain optimal well-being with appropriate initiatives that encourage and facilitate healthy living and the prevention of disease, disability, and injury. There is a lot embedded in that, so I won't go into it. But if you get a chance, delve into it. I think you'll find it of interest, I hope. Once again, the Health Committee is highlighting Medicaid expansion. There is a lot within our report that goes into the other areas of the healthcare sector. But for the third year in a row, we've decided this is one of the most important aspects of healthcare in Utah. We have, this is about the third year in a row that we've discussed this. In prior years, we have suggested that there are moral and ethical reasons for expansion. Last year, we emphasized is a fairness issue where just about everyone in this country has some kind of subsidy except for this small group of adults, both parents as well as singles, and feel that just is not fair. And prior, we had one member suggest that not covering this group was akin to human sacrifice. But I don't want to get into that anymore today. What I want to suggest is that there's quite a bit of research that's starting to accumulate now that Medicaid expansion has been present in it's over 30 states now. Kaiser Family Foundation has compiled over 150 studies now, and most of that research is showing positive impacts of Medicaid expansion. So, starting out with increased access, the first bullet, more people are covered. Seems like obvious, but embedded in that are a couple of other things that may be a little bit more subtle. So the research is not showing showing that there is minimal or no crowd out. That is, people are not dropping private coverage in order to access Medicaid coverage. It's also showing access, positive aspect improvements in subpopulations. So we're seeing more veterans covered. We're seeing more people with HIV/AIDS covered, as well as other populations. Also finding there's an increase in the diagnosis of chronic care conditions. So people know they have the condition and they can find treatment. There's increased access to medications, increased treatment of mental health conditions, and providers have generally increased capacity to be able to cover this, the increase in the number of patients. There are some increase in waiting times, so there, you know, it's not a perfect situation, but not nearly as difficult as many assumed there might be early on. There's also some positive impacts around affordability and economic outcomes, as well as quality. States have seen revenue gains and economic growth. Interestingly enough, the spending per enrollee for the new eligibles has turned out to be a little bit less than some of the traditional Medicaid adults, and that cost per enrollee has been going down for that this expansion group as states get a better handle on costs and coverage. There's some one study would indicate lower marketplace premiums. That's the exchange area in states that have expanded Medicaid. And also, obviously, reduction in uncompensated care. And there have been positive or neutral impacts on job growth in states. So while we have focused on Medicaid expansion, I do want to point out that is only one piece of the puzzle, but we see it as an important piece. And that there are many positives coming from it, but the report addresses the need to focus on quality and cost with stronger emphasis on the need to become more active in addressing the determinants of health. We hope and urge our community to move forward with Medicaid expansion and some reform of the system without waiting for our national government to act. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Dee Rowland, and I retired from the Catholic Diocese as their government liaison about 6 or 7 years ago, I believe. Personal security is Article 5. All Utahns have the right to security of person, especially freedom from physical harm and psychological abuse, whether experienced within the family or in the community at large. So there are many aspects of personal safety, but the UCC board decided to focus on gun safety for today's report. That priority was selected, ironically, before the horror of the Las Vegas shootings. In these days of fake news, I just wanted to assure you of the efforts by the authors, and they're out here too, of this publication, to footnote every stated fact and to cite peer-reviewed studies. It's the best thing about UCC, I think. The leading fact of Article 5 is that every year, 33,000 Americans are killed by guns, and for every death, 2 others are wounded. That means about 100,000 victims a year in the United States. The American Journal of Medicine found that Americans were 10 times more likely to die from firearms than citizens in 22 other highly developed nations. Those authors concluded that firearms are killing rather than protecting us. One common sense solution would seem to be to require background checks for every purchase, whether bought from a licensed gun dealer, a gun show, or in a private transaction. Currently, around 40% of gun transfers happen without a criminal background check. So that has been one of our recommendations throughout the years of this report. But instead, there is a continuing effort by some Utah legislators to allow permitless carry, which would remove the necessity of a background check. This is in spite of the fact that Utah's Bureau of Criminal Investigation confirmed that 342 concealed carry permits were denied in 2015-16 due to domestic violence convictions or protective orders. In 2016 alone, 1,583 concealed carry permits were denied and 1,630 permits revoked because background checks revealed issues from outstanding warrants to mental illness to drug offenses. Background checks save lives, and comprehensive background checks would save more lives. Let's talk about domestic violence. Despite its low overall homicide rate, Utah's domestic violence-related homicides account for 42% of total homicides. This compares with 30% in around the U.S. So in other words, while we have this wonderful statistic of lower homicides overall, the percentage of domestic violence homicides is 12% higher. Firearms were the source of nearly 60% of Utah's domestic violence-related homicides. There are two slightly good things happening on this issue, with House Bill 206 passing in this year's legislative session. It aligns Utah law with the federal law that requires that anyone under protective orders or with a domestic violence record shall not possess or purchase firearms, and thus it will help enforcement. The second area of progress is the use of the Lethality Assessment Protocol. Try saying that three times. We refer to it as LAP. When LAP-trained police officers arrive at the scene of a domestic violence incident, they administer an 11-point questionnaire. If it indicates a high level of danger, officers put the victim in touch with a domestic violence shelter. 46 Utah police departments have adopted this procedure and employed it in over 4,000 situations. One of our recommendations this year is that the legislature should add dating conflicts to the category of domestic violence to establish consistency with Utah's protective orders and to enhance police authority. Dating partners account for 25% of violence between intimate partners. So, in Utah, every year since 2009, gun deaths have outnumbered motor vehicle deaths. Great progress has been made in reducing automobile deaths through regulations such as licensing, driver training, safety features, and age restrictions. It's our belief that similar restrictions could save lives and families destroyed by gun violence. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Cheryl May, and I worked for many years as a teaching adjunct in political science at BYU and the University of Utah, and then switched career paths and worked for 15 years as the head curator down at the BYU Museum of Art. And in terms of our social support systems rights declaration, all Utahns have the right to fundamental social support systems that assist in assuring a standard of living adequate to the well-being of both individuals and families in all their configurations, including timely assistance in case of unemployment, disability, old age, and natural and man-made disasters. And I'm reading fast because a four-minute time limit is brutal. In thinking about an image to exemplify Utah's affordable housing problem, one might first picture a scene like this one of homeless people in front of the Catholic Community Day Center over on 4th West. And the affordable housing crisis certainly increases homelessness, but that's just the tip of a huge iceberg of housing insecurity suffered by tens of thousands in this state. So I think a better illustration might be this one of Raphael, a local waiter, and you see his back in this shot. He shares a bedroom with his mother in this less than 500 square foot apartment, rents out beds in the living room to two others, and then his brother sleeps on a bedroll in the kitchen, which he has to roll up each morning so that people can get into the kitchen and out the front door. This kind of overcrowding causes great discomfort and stress for adults, but it's even harder on little children. The toxic stress caused by frequent moves, occasional evictions, attending 5 to 7 schools in a year, actually causes children's brains to shrink. They have trouble focusing, their cognitive and emotional development is greatly impeded, and fully 30% of children in Salt Lake City are living in poverty, many of them in insecure housing. A recent research report by the National Low Income Housing Coalition concluded that, quote, "Research shows that increasing access to affordable housing is the most cost-effective strategy for reducing childhood poverty in the United States," close quote. The root cause of this crisis is a serious disconnect in our capitalist system. In a booming economy like ours with a relative scarcity of workers, high employer demand raises wages. In Utah between 2011 and 2016, wages increased by 4%. The problem is that the market for rentals also responded to demand, and during the same period, the average rent price increased by 26%, over 6.5 times the wage increase. Capitalist economies deal with this disconnect through a set of policies we call the safety net. The 60,000 plus Utahns in the lowest income groups need a supplement in order to pay their rent. Most of these supplements come from the federal government, but all the Utah REP supplement programs combined cover only about 19,000 people, and that leaves 40,000 plus with nowhere to turn for affordable housing. To deal with this problem, we need to increase the inventory of affordable housing and increase the incomes of those who make the least. With current federal policies aimed at reducing rather than increasing housing aid, state and local government and community groups must step up. This year, the legislature passed a modest bill providing credits to help developers build affordable housing, and Salt Lake City has made a bigger commitment, assembling $21.6 million for redevelopment money, for various measures to promote affordable housing. The county's Collective Impact Initiative concentrates on facilities for the homeless and the services they need to find stable housing. Community groups like Habitat for Humanity, YWCA, and others work hard to help the poor find stable housing. But the current level of effort leaves tens of thousands continuing to suffer the ills of housing insecurity. The state and local commitment to build affordable units and provide rent supplements must be greatly increased. On the income side, we recommend that Utah join the 26 other states that have enacted a state-level earned income tax credit. Establishing a state EITC at 10% of the current federal level, as was proposed by the last legislature, would be a good starting point. Only if we join the many other countries that do a much better job at providing decent housing for virtually all citizens, can we claim to be a state that takes seriously the promise of equal opportunity for all. Thank you.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. This week, members of the Utah Citizens Council spoke at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. The group is an independent, nonpartisan group of senior community advocates who are dedicated to improving public policy on complex issues through dialogue, creative problem solving, and consensus building. And they wanted to highlight their report for 2017, which advocates actions to be taken on several key policy issues, including air quality and future of water availability, public education financing and the Our Schools Now initiative petition, healthcare costs and quality and the continuing need for Medicaid expansion, personal security and the need to address gun violence, also the lack of affordable housing for low-income residents in our state, and last but not least, gerrymandering and the Better Boundaries Redistricting Initiative. The speakers this hour include Andy Schoenberg, who's a former professor of biophysics and bioengineering at the University of Utah, John Bennion, who served as a superintendent for the Salt Lake City and Provo school districts, Michael Diley, a former state director of the Utah Medicaid program, Cheryl May, a former adjunct associate professor in the Department of Political Science, Dee Rowland, a former government liaison for the Catholic Diocese of Utah, and speaking next is Dixie Hoefner, a former professor of special education and law at the University of Utah.
I'm Dixie Hoefner, and I am an emeritus professor of special ed law in the Hughes College of Education and was the communications chair for Utahns for Ethical Government a while back. The last article of our Declaration of Utah Human Rights states, all Utahns have the right to transparent and ethical governance as well as effective participation in the democratic process. Over the past 3 years, we've focused in three areas: campaign finance reform, the nominating process for political office, and redistricting reform. This year, we're focusing on redistricting to reduce gerrymandering for legislative seats. Under Utah's constitution, the state legislature is authorized to redraw state boundaries and congressional boundaries for legislative seats after each 10-year national census. The next census is 2020, and the districts must be roughly equal in population. When a state is controlled by one political party, its legislature has become extremely smart at using highly sophisticated computer mapping techniques to produce gerrymandered boundaries. The fox is guarding the hen house. To use a military analogy, gerrymandering is like allowing one side's military not only to control where to position its own troops, but where to position the troops of the opposing army to be sure that the opposing troops are outmaneuvered in all major battles. Allowing politicians to decide who votes where means they can defeat the other side before the elections even start. The slide on the screen, courtesy of Wikipedia, illustrates how rigging boundaries can produce unrepresentative outcomes. If districts perfectly represented voters, green would win 60% of the districts because green accounts for 60% of the voters. If you draw deliberately unfair boundaries, like the second graphic, green wins all the districts. If you manipulate in another way, like the third graphic, yellow wins 60% of the districts while representing only 40% of the voters. This gives you a little idea of how sophisticated this computer mapping can become. In 2011, the Utah legislature split Salt Lake County in thirds, placing large portions of Salt Lake City with rural areas of the state down all the way and including St. George. It split Tooele in half, Holiday in thirds, Moab right down the middle of Main Street, and about a dozen other municipalities and several formerly Democratic districts. Republicans ended up with 83% of the legislature in spite of getting only 67% of the voters. Gerrymandering has also produced increasingly poor voter turnout, more uncontested elections, and more non-competitive races. It hurts Democrats, Republicans, and unaffiliated voters alike. A nonpartisan group called Utahns for Responsive Government has launched a Better Boundaries Initiative campaign to place on the 2018 ballot a proposal to establish an independent redistricting commission to redraw the congressional and the state legislative district boundaries after the 2020 census. It will use a nonpartisan set of standards. If the legislature wants to reject the commission's maps, protections are built into the initiative to discourage it from partisan tampering. Passing the Better Boundaries Initiative would be an important step in reducing the current polarization infecting both major political parties, would increase the likelihood of centrists regaining power, improve government transparency and accountability, help voters understand that their vote counts, and help restore the people's trust in democracy. An easy way to envision the purpose of the Better Boundaries Initiative is that it is to enable voters to elect their political representatives rather than representatives selecting their voters. It's important, and UCC really supports this initiative. Now, that's the end of our highlighting, and we will welcome questions and answers, and your attendance up here afterwards if you want to pick up a copy of the report.
Sure. So despite the broad array of public policies that we covered today, we have a significant amount of time for questions. Therefore, I'll be bringing around the microphone. Just please state your name, a little bit about yourself, and then go ahead and ask your question. So I'll begin with whoever wants it first.
Hi there. Thank you so much for your comments, and especially across the myriad of issues that I think Utahns have a grave concern about. I'm State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauck. I wanted to ask, related to your participatory democracy or participatory government platform in the articles, if you've had an opportunity to address concerns related to the upcoming census. There's a number of us that have concerns about the fact that the Trump administration is proposed to cut it markedly, that the census must be implemented utilizing the same amount of funds that were allocated for the 2010 census, that they're focusing primarily on using technology, and I have some concerns about what that will look like in our rural communities here in Utah, as well as for marginalized communities, and was hoping that the council might review the concerns related to the 2020 census to make sure that not only that redistricting is done appropriately, but that Utah gets what it deserves in terms of federal funding allocations. Thanks.
I hope everybody heard. Is this on? What Representative Chavez-Hauck said, because it's absolutely right. And although we did not take a position in our report as this was evolving, one of the things we care most about as a Utah Citizens Council is that the citizenry awake, be awake and taking their fair share of responsibility in helping shape policy. And so this is a live issue, and while we can't speak as a whole council, we'll be following it in the coming months as the legislature convenes and as the federal legislature continues to do its work, because obviously if you don't get a good count, it's throwing everything off in terms of the way you draw your boundaries. So thank you for drawing that to our attention.
Hello, my name is Clayton Booth, and just want to say thanks for coming to do this. I'm an international studies student here at the U, and I'm also a pre-dental student. So my two questions are for the healthcare portion, if it's okay that I ask two questions. First is, I'm just wondering what the effects of President Trump's executive order concerning health insurance are, like what effects does that have on Utah and also the nation? And then my second question, if you can comment on the medical cannabis proposition that's coming up in the next election in Utah.
Two questions, you don't get two answers though. Seriously, on the cannabis, the council has not taken a position on that. I think we were asked the same thing last year, and so I really can't speak for the council on that. In terms of the most recent executive orders and directions, again, it's kind of outside the, what we've done on the council, but I think in terms, there's a number of ways it can go. I think what people are looking at now is that the increase in premiums have already been kind of embedded into next year's cost, and so there's some information coming out that the recipients in some ways may be better off because they will continue to get the premium subsidy on the exchange, and that so they will not be paying more, and they are also held, at least the lower income group will still receive the benefit of the subsidies that aren't being paid. So in theory, the insurance companies have already increased the rate in anticipation of the cost, and the beneficiaries shouldn't see much of a impact, except for those individuals who are not subject to subsidy. They get the benefit of the higher premium, but not the benefit of the subsidy, so they will end up taking a hit. That's my understanding of it.
To follow up on that, I've been reading some articles which I don't understand. Oh, I'm Louise. I'm actually on the committee. anyway, which suggests that the silver policy, which is the one which people who get subsidies take, that the impact on the premiums is for the silver policies alone, and that the gold and the bronze and the platinum, if anybody can afford it, will not be affected by that, so that it's arguably true that people will pay less for a gold policy than a silver policy and get better coverage, and that if they can afford it, it's actually a good thing. Not that I think that what Trump did was a good thing, but that it's not a complete disaster if you know how to work the system.
That's kind of what I was referencing, but I have not run the numbers or seen the numbers, so I think some of that remains to be seen. And then some obvious concern about people who choose a bronze plan and end up having to pay a lot more in co-payments. So I think people have to be careful, once again, have to be careful and know what they are purchasing.
Pam Perlick with the Gardner Policy Institute. Just in going forward, the housing issues that you've raised also dovetail with the Census 2020 issues. There is a master address list that should be assembled by the government, by our local governments right now, to give the addresses of where people are living. And some of these places where people have multi-households within a single unit are not legal residences. They don't have addresses. They're, what should we say, accessory dwelling units. And there are, at this point, in preparing for Census 2020, this is where we do all the groundwork. They need to have all the addresses in for the group quarters populations, as well as all of the residences. So there is a connection between the housing crisis and the increase in the hard-to-count populations.
Yeah. They don't get counted, which means that the basis for federal programs is distorted, and Did I get up the shot of Raphael? I can't remember whether he came. Okay, so the reason that we saw his back rather than his front is because he'd put drywall up in the living room so that he could make half of the living room into a bedroom, which was totally illegal. But I think that's the kind of thing that Pam is referring to, and that it seems like another case where the people who need the help most are being denied the help.
Hello, I'm Kilo Zamora, the former Salt Lake City Human Rights Commissioner Chair and teacher in the Gender Studies Division here at the University of Utah. First of all, thank you all so much. I have to say that if this was a bumper sticker, I'd have to put it on my car every day because I really value the work that you're doing. I'm wondering if you've ever taken time to step back and think about what your work would look like if you put a lens of race and gender over it, because it seems to me that under each of your areas, your priorities may shift as you think about housing, as you think about the environment, as you think about safety, that all of a sudden when we think about things like gun control, when you add race in there, we might not be thinking about gun control as much as we're thinking about like police officers. When we're thinking about safety in women, we're thinking about maybe sexual assault as one of the most pressing issues, or affordable housing and mothers with children. So I'm just wondering if that's been a thought for you all about how you make a new analysis and the value would be to consider those specific marginalized communities under the examination of your policies.
I will say that I think that's an excellent point, because we have started talking about how we can do a better job of integrating the Human Rights Declaration separate articles, because they connect and they interrelate. And the health report this year, for instance, took a look at the relationship between health care, health delivery, basic good health, and gun violence. That was a start. They also have talked about the relationship of the denial of the poverty issues that relate to health. So you're just one step ahead of us, but we've started thinking that way, that there would be very rich interconnections if we started exploring. And you're raising the exploration of our first article on equal rights and equal dignity and equal protection to how that impacts our other article. So thank you very much for the comment.
And let me just add that I think it's quite evident that in terms of affordable housing, that those in our Hispanic community tend to have a bigger percentage suffering from these problems, and of course, single moms. So there are lots of dimensions to what you're talking about.
Hello, I'm Jennifer Jones with the Bennion Center, and you mentioned a moment ago that citizens need to take active ownership in these areas. I'm wondering if you have a strategy to overcome ignorance and apathy amongst the general population. And if you have a strategy, what is it?
Well, I would just say, but I'll let the education specialist expand on that. But certainly education is the about data, real facts is the basic. We need real facts to address, to acknowledge the problem, and then the next step is to work on solving it. But right now it seems like it's such a struggle to get factual information, or at least to prevent conspiracies and non-facts from spreading and being so prolific. So I think our support of the education initiative is one way to do that.
As I indicated in my opening remarks, I'm just so impressed the way some very high visible business leaders have taken the lead on this initiative and are giving time and money to make sure that that petition drive succeeds. The president of the Chamber of Commerce is a champion of the initiative, and he has enormous influence in the business community. So I'm very heartened by that. And at least at this point, if the election were held today, so to speak, the initiative would probably pass. But I also anticipate a lot of negative pushback when it gets closer, and that there is in this state a lot of anti-tax sentiment, and that that's going to become more and more visible as we get closer. So it's not going to be easy, but we've got a lot of good forces, other than just educators, that are really trying to get the public to support this.
Nancy Honstead, you mentioned the mass killings in Las Vegas, and I'm wondering if you can predict whether or not Congress will respond with any kind of gun control.
No, no. And I think, ironically, I just came back from a Washington conference on gun safety issues, and the pain of people who have worked on this issue for years and years is just overwhelming. The fact that the mass killings bring us all to our knees, but the mass killings also have to bring us to our feet to do something about them. And of course, we rely on our legislatures and our federal government. Two bills at the federal level were set to sail through Congress this session. One of them was the so-called silencer bill. It's H.R. 367, and it would deregulate the need. In other words, it would enable people to use silencers. And I don't think it takes a genius to figure out that if a criminal has a silencer on his or her gun, it certainly would increase the hazards of the actions there. So that has it's been pulled back. Hopefully, it will not come to terms again. But unfortunately, all of our three House members, our present three House members, have supported that. And coincidentally, the silencers are manufactured in Utah. Well. four, yes, but right now we presently have three, right. But yes, Chaffetz did sign onto it. So that was one, and the other is concealed carry reciprocity, H.R. 38 and Senate 446. That would actually take the lowest common denominator for regulations in all states and make it, in other words, you could use your permit all over. It's going to the lowest, I think it's 12 states that do not do not require permits. So again, that would be very stupid. So if it's hard to think, hopefully those will be restrained. And of course, there are also Senator Feinstein has a bill introduced on, you've all heard about the addition of stocks, and there are three bills in the House which probably won't go anywhere, but that would regulate the size of magazines and the high capacity weapons, which are so unnecessary. So it all depends, I think, on citizen action. We've got to let our legislators know, and we've got to get the facts out about the extent of gun violence, the deaths, and the injuries. Part of my depression coming home is spending 3 days with so many victims who either survived injuries to themselves, but their life is never the same. And we have victims here in Utah who walk around with lead embedded in their body and just have incredible suffering because of gun injuries. So just educating the public about the extent of damage and the fact that it doesn't happen in other civilized countries. Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, then, please join me in thanking our panel and the Bennion Center for their participation today.
You've been listening to a presentation by members of the Utah Citizens Council titled Standing Up for Utah's Needs, Environmental Health, Public Education Financing, Medicaid Expansion, Gun Control, Affordable Housing, and Redistricting. You can find a link to the Utah Citizens Council's report on our website. The forum today was co-sponsored by the Lowell Binion Community Service Center, and this program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.